Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hillary, Andrew, Martin, Mark, Elizabeth, Kirsten, and Amy. Markle, Paul, Chris, Rand, Scott, Bobby, Jeb, Rick, Ted, John, Peter, Mike, Rick, Scott B., and in some living rooms, John K., if you live in Ohio, that is. Those are the names on the Democratic and Republican sides that are being bandied about for possible runs for the president, the office of president. Joining us now with last names and his insights on what's ahead in the never-ending cycle of U.S. presidential politics, NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Your last time on the show as NPR's political junkie. Welcome to the show.
I know. I never know what to wear on these shows. But, you know, there's only 2.5 years before the next presidential election.
It's not enough time.
Iowa. So I think we have, you know, I think we're not starting too early at all. Right.
Right. No, we're not. I mean, there's stuff out there to talk about.
Well, you know, the candidates are, I mean, some, it's funny, on the Democratic side, it seems like the convention of wisdom is that Hillary Clinton has it locked down and there's no reason for anybody else, including the sitting vice president of the United States, to get involved, although Hillary Clinton is not saying anything, you know, but of course NBC is saying something because they have this miniseries coming out on her, and CNN is saying something because they have this documentary coming out on her, but she's just giving speeches, writing a book, and saying, gee, you know, I'll think about it later. But I don't think there's any doubt that the nomination is hers, that she wants it. And on the Republican side, you know, it's everybody. It's everybody you could think of.
Well, almost every middle-aged white male you could think of.
Well, there aren't too many black males or black females in the Republican Party. And I mean, in all fairness, I mean, you know, the Democratic Party, until 2008, didn't nominate a non-white male for president until Obama. So this is, you know, things are changing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, after the last run at it, there were a lot more women on the Republican side, ethnicity beside the point. Now there's not one on the list of, you know, from what I've seen, that's being seriously considered on the Republican side.
Well, that's true. I mean, and you did have Michelle Bachmann in 2008, and of course, the highlight of her candidacy was winning the Iowa straw poll in the summer of 2007. But then she finished last in Iowa, and she was gone from the race immediately after. So, you haven't seen the kind of look. There's only one Hillary Clinton, and it seems like that's going to be the testing point for a woman to make history, just as Barack Obama made history in 2008.
I was reading a Christian Science Monitor story about the Democratic side of the equation, and they referred to the fierce battle already underway to define Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I ask you, what is to define? She's been an author, a first lady, a U.S. senator, a secretary of state, and a presidential candidate. What is left to know about her? In fact, you know, I've read her autobiography before. What more is there to know?
Well, I guess the thing is, what has she accomplished? I mean, some of the questions are, and I've seen that even from liberal commentators, liberal journalists who say that, well, yes, she ran for president, yes, she was a senator, and yes, she was Secretary of State, but even as Secretary of State, she was implementing Barack Obama's foreign policy. So what has she done was some of the questions happening. Well, you know, compared to like Elizabeth Warren, who was a consumer activist and really had a whole, you know, a real record and a sign of activism. So there are some people who say that, look, Hillary Clinton should just coast to the nomination, be very cognizant of the mistakes she made in 2008, but there's no reason for her to start this early. And there's others who say that, you know, look, let people get to know you even better, which I agree with you. I agree with that, the basis of your question, that, look, if we don't know Hillary Clinton by now, nothing that anybody's going to say, nothing that Hillary's going to say, nothing that CNN and NBC are going to say is going to change the equation.
One article calls her the instant front runner. Is that instantly a bad taste in some people's mouths? They don't like being told who the instant front runner is.
Well, I've always hated that word because front runner, I mean, usually you like to say that the voters should have something to say about this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember, not go back to 2007. We were all convinced, and I'm one of those people who were convinced that Hillary Clinton, the nomination was hers if she wanted it. You know, it was theirs for the taking. Nobody expected a Barack Obama or anybody to come up and snatch the nomination away from her. So front runners are a very odd thing, as you know, as President Ed Muskie will tell you, that it just, you know, it doesn't always happen. But again, Again, we're talking about two and a half years before Iowa and New Hampshire. It's hard to imagine anybody taking the nomination away from Hillary Clinton if she wants it. Whereas on the Republican side, if I was pressed, I couldn't tell you who that nominee will be.
Yeah, let's see. Marco, Paul, Chris Rand. Well, let's talk about, listeners, it's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, for the last time on our show. Ken, you will be missed in that role.
Well, thank you. It was, I've only spent 20 years at NPR, and it was some of the most rewarding and exciting years of my life, clearly. And of course, I'm not retiring. I'm leaving to spend more time with my family. No, that's not true at all. But there will be a return of the Political Junkie column and the Scuttlebutt and Puzzle and perhaps a podcast. So things are not disappearing, shall we say, especially with these great campaigns coming up.
Exactly. Okay, then this is another issue I wondered about. The same article that called her an instant front runner also referred to her in her late 60s and Vice President Joe Biden in his mid-70s. And I'm wondering, is that the same thing as late 60s if you're a woman? Does age matter when talking about gender? Can an older man, do you have to be a younger woman than an older man? And I don't know if that any of that makes sense. Does it matter how old you are depending on what your gender is?
Well, no, I don't think so. And I don't know what age matters, except for the fact that people will say it matters. I mean, of course, Ronald Reagan in 1980 was elected for the first time at 69 years old, and he was the oldest president ever, first elected president. And people said, well, he showed signs of aging even in 1980, 1981. So Hillary Clinton, of course, will be 69 Inauguration Day in 2017. Joe Biden will be 73. I mean, ageism is a very difficult thing to talk about. You could be very old at 35.
So, except you can't run for. Oh no, is that the use of the Supreme Court that you can't at a certain age? No, you can. No. You serve for life.
Well, of course, you don't run for the Supreme Court,
but you can be
appointed forever. And most Supreme Court justices are carried out. Sad to say, they don't retire because of age. They die in office. Mm-hmm. The fact that Sandra Day O'Connor left early, and that was more of a family decision, that's really the exception to the rule.
Once again, the family. Okay, here comes a spoil sport. Terry in Columbus, you're on the air.
Okay, hi there. It seems to me
go
that
for it.
It seems to me the only thing that the media wants to talk about is elections, 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 and it's way too early to be talking about it when it's just in the beginning of Obama's term.
Second term. Okay.
Well,
Ken?
Look, I obviously focus on elections and campaigns because just like I would, anybody who loves to talk about sports will talk about sports. I think the media, it is kind of silly, the fact that, as Ann said earlier, who is the front runner and who's not. But the point is, yes, it's ridiculous, but at least on the Republican side, well, even the Democratic side too, candidates are going to Iowa. Joe Biden was in Iowa. He's going to South Carolina. Republicans, Rick Santorum was recently in Iowa. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, they're all looking or talking about going to Iowa. So, sure, the media can be obsessed by this. And, of course, we're basically just one year, not even a year into mm-hmm. President Obama's second term. But the candidates are going, they are making the steps that make it sound like, at least, that they're looking at 2016 in the presidential race.
Right. It's not too early if you're running.
Well, the argument is, of course, Hillary Clinton could wait to the last second because mm-hmm. everybody knows who she is. And it's the unknown people, the folks like the Ted Cruzes and the Rand Pauls, people who don't know as much. They're the ones who need to get out. Even Scott Walker, for example, the governor of Wisconsin, they're the people who should be out early because, to get named. But, you remember in the past, Mo Udall, the former congressman from Arizona, declared his candidacy 2 years early in advance of 1976. And everybody thought that was nuts. And of course, you need to do it if you're not well known. But the perfect example is Jimmy Carter. Nobody knew who Jimmy Carter was. He was Jimmy Who for the longest time. Mm-hmm. But he was out and about, doing the anonymous tours of Iowa and New Hampshire with nobody taking notice. Unfortunately, that was back in the day when you didn't have the 24/7 media you know, the excitement, the politicos of the world that had they couldn't catch their breath, you know, to talk without talking about presidential elections 2-3 years in advance. Back then, you could slip under the radar and suddenly wind up as the nominee. Those days are long gone.
Terry, thanks for your call. Of course, a lot of people are looking at the this next election cycle, where a lot of governors are going to be reelected or elected, including Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's up for reelection in the next year, and has been bandied about. There was a Wall Street Journal article about him. You and I have talked about John Kasich before as a potential national figure. Well, he's been a national figure before, but as a candidate for president.
Well, you know, I mean, he did run for president once before.
That's right.
It was short-lived, but it was in advance of 2000. He was the House Budget Committee chairman, who had enough national power. And, you know, he's up for re-election, of course, in 2014. Mm-hmm. Now, I saw a recent PPP poll, the Democratic-leaning poll, that showed him actually trailing the likely Democratic candidate, Ed Fitzgerald, I mean, just by a few points. But so, of course, we can't go beyond 2014 for John Kasich. But if he wins, you know, Ohio is a pretty hefty state with electoral clout. And the fact is that he had a national inclination back in 2000, and he may have it again. But, of course, you know, you still have 2014 to get by.
You have a question or comment for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Okay, so how does the nation one-up itself in 2016, elect a woman, or at least finally get one on the winning ticket as a vice presidential nominee, something like that? What's the next act? What do Americans do?
Well, you know, like your caller said before, maybe they shouldn't do anything until after the 2014 elections. Once that's out of the way, you know, then you can see what's going to happen in 2016. Look, George Bush was reelected in 2004, and he was talking about the political capital he has earned. And not long after that, the weariness about the war and the economy and the handling of Hurricane Katrina and all that, they said, whoa, what happened to this longstanding Republican dominance of politics? And then came 2006, when the Democrats captured the House, they captured the governorship of Ohio, which is, I know there's a state law that says that Democrats are not allowed to be elected governor of Ohio, but it changed in 2006. And then 2008, of course, with Barack Obama. The midterm elections are very, very significant. But mm-hmm. having said that, one of the great examples is 1994 with the Gingrich Revolution, when the Republicans won all those seats in the House, all those seats in the Senate. They took control. You know, Bob Dole became Senate Majority Leader. Gingrich became Speaker. But 2 years later, Bill Clinton won an easy victory. Look at 2010, when the Republicans won everywhere in the country in the midterm election of 2010. But 2 years later, Barack Obama won a second term. So, you know, we can get very excited about what the midterm elections mean and how the party is aiming for the presidential election. But 2 years, we've seen this over and over and over again. 2 years can be a lifetime in politics, just like tonight's this 1 hour show can seem like a lifetime in politics.
And yet the first segment has just flown by.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's not a while. Okay.
Okay. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for him, once again, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, you mentioned earlier that the CNN and NBC news plans. NBC Entertainment actually has announced plans to produce a biographical film about Hillary Clinton for air in 2015. And CNN's documentary division is producing a biopic about her sometime next year. Republicans have voted to bar them from partnering in the 2016 debates. What does that mean? How much power do they have to do that?
Well, I think, basically what the RNC decided in their vote, which was unanimous, by the way, was to say that they urging the state parties who put on these individual debates have no connection at all, no dealings at all with CNN or NBC. Now, I think what it is, what it comes down to is that the Republican Party is convinced, or at least a lot of people in the Republican Party are convinced, that the media was part of this deification of Barack Obama in 2008. He became larger than life mostly because, in their words, or their thoughts, because of favorable media coverage. And they're very fearful that the same thing could happen once again with Hillary Clinton in 2016. So they're saying, okay, if you're going to run these documentaries, one Republican said, look, for God's sakes, they're having Diane Lane, portraying Hillary Clinton. Why not Nathan Lane is what they said.
Diane Lane. Wow.
When you think of Hillary Clinton, I immediately think of either Diane Lane or Heidi Klum. That's exactly who I think of. But it's just like, could you imagine a documentary on Michelle Bachmann and somebody being very, well, that's not the point. The point is the Republicans are so fearful that the media bias will take over the dialogue and the conversation in 2016. But look, the point is, and this may not be the perfect example, but remember what happened in 1984 or 1983 when The Right Stuff came out, the movie The Right Stuff novel, and all the Democrats and some Republicans were saying, this is going to make John Glenn the next president of the United States. But the point is, John Glenn still had to prove himself in the debates. He still had to raise money. He still had to get establishment support. He still had to make a convincing case for his candidacy. So for all the whatever what's going to come out of CNN and NBC, and I have no idea what it's going to be like, Hillary Clinton still has to make the argument to the American people that she should continue the already 8 years of Democratic rule to make it 12 years.
When it comes to not participating or not partnering in 16 debates, you're saying that they're asking the local the states and the locals not to play ball with the local affiliates, even.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let's just say there's going to be a Republican debate in New Hampshire in December of 2015, and NBC or CNN wants to sponsor it. In other words, they want to, and they'll say, "No, we're going to give it to ABC. We'll give it to Fox News. We'll give it to CBS." It was not the vote that the RNC took is not binding on the parties, but it just seems like that's what's going to happen and it's unlikely to be overruled. It sounds petty to many people, but I think the Republican Party feels that enough is enough, and this is bias showing, clear bias showing, and we're not going to take it anymore.
Okay, Ed in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I was just going to make a comment and get your all's opinion that it feels like to me that America is kind of high on itself on what they elect, and regardless of who they elect. In other words, and then you kind of pointed out already, you said, what should we do next? Is it Hillary? Who's the next woman? Is America just wants to, do the next great thing instead of elect a great person. Does that even make sense?
Yeah. I get what you're saying. Ken, do you think that's the driving force or part of it?
There used to be a bit on Saturday Night Live called Short Attention Span Theater. And I think a lot of political junkies have that. Okay, we got through the election. I know there's 4 more years, but let's talk about the next election. Let's talk about who's going to run in 2016. Wait, maybe George P. Bush may run in 2020. Let's talk about that for an hour. Whereas there's so much on President Obama's plate, everything you see what's going on with the Mideast, with the economy, with the Bradley Manning verdict, and talking about whether he should be pardoned or not, the NSA thing. So there's so much that Obama has to deal with, and yet, so many of us, and I guess this conversation is one indication of it, but I understand what we're doing here. But this, there's so many people who just say, well, let's just look ahead to 2016 and not talk about what the real problems that are facing the country and what Americans expect and demand of their or the people they've elected.
Now, on a second comment, if I could, I think Obama is so powerful and has so much influence that whoever he supports, that's going to be our next president.
Hmm.
Well, there's something to be said about that, but and here's the irony here. First of all, he has a choice between a very loyal vice president, Joe Biden. You remember him? He was the guy who was elected vice president.
I've mentioned him once.
Yeah, he was in a lot of the papers. And a very loyal Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And plus the fact that, I mean, if you make the argument that, well, Bill Clinton did so much to elect, to help reelect Barack Obama in 2012. Remember that great speech at the convention?
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, there's no way that Barack Obama can you know, snub Hillary Clinton and back as vice president. And that's pretty amazing because, one, no vice president in recent memory who's wanted the presidential nomination has failed to get it. You think of Nixon, you think of Al Gore, you think of George Bush Sr., Hubert Humphrey. I mean, all these vice presidents wanted the nomination and they got it. And this is very interesting that that Joe Biden is saying he's almost like a second thought given this adulation of Hillary Clinton, given the fact that again, once again, history is in the making. And, you know, it's kind of sad watching what Joe Biden may have to decide going into the 2016 election. But he said, look, if I die without becoming president, it's not going to be the worst thing in the world.
All right, Ed, thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment for Ken Rudin, he's on the phone right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Yeah, yes, thank you. Well, we're going to miss you.
Thank you.
But,
he's not going away.
Okay. You're going to bring him back on the show?
Well,
I'm attending my own funeral. It's amazing.
Anyway, the most important thing about the 2016 election to me is the Supreme Court. And the next president in 2016 could pick a lot of Supreme Court members. I just want to get your opinion on that.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I always think of the campaign button that NARAL put out during the Bush-Gore race in 2000, and basically playing off the expression, is the economy stupid? NARAL said, is the Supreme Court stupid?
Mm.
And you know, given the fact that so many of these court decisions on campaign finance, on race, on redistricting, on same-sex marriage, a lot of these votes have been 5-4 decisions. So any kind of retirement, any kind of vacancy in the Supreme Court, depending on who the president is, who will make the replacement, is so crucial. I mean, a lot of people are saying that, like, that the Roe versus Wade decision is really right now one vote away from being overturned. So, again, both sides have so much at stake. Everybody says, well, it doesn't matter who's president, but it certainly matters who's going to be on the Supreme Court because they affect so much of what's going on in American culture and life that I think Supreme Court is one of those less mentioned but so crucial issues for a presidential election. I agree completely.
Okay, Ken, thanks a lot.
I agree with anything somebody named Ken.
Okay, Ken, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Aaron. He writes, what's your take on the Virginia governor's race? Ken Cuccinelli doesn't seem to be that strong of a candidate, but Terry McAuliffe has his weaknesses too.
Well, both Ken, this is of course, you know, there were two gubernatorial elections up in November. Both Virginia and New Jersey will be electing governors. But, I mean, the one in Virginia is really, really interesting because you have two flawed candidates. Terry McAuliffe, the former Clinton money guy, the guy who ran for governor 4 years ago, is, you know, there are a lot of questions about his financial arrangements, about his deals and everything like that. And there's a lot of ethics, no allegations, but just questions. And the New York Times has focused a whole bunch of things on some failed business projects that McAuliffe was a part of. But at the same time, Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican, the former state attorney general, is one of those really, really conservative state officials who battled Obama from day one on Obamacare, a very strong anti-abortion candidate. And it's some people think that he's much, much too conservative to win a gubernatorial election. Now, what's interesting is that Virginia has this history that whoever's in the White House, whatever party's in the White House, the next year they elect the governor of the opposite party. The last time a Virginia Democrat won the governorship while there's a Democrat in the White House was 1965. So for Terry McAuliffe to win the governorship of Virginia with a Democrat in the White House, it shows that there's tremendous weakness with Cuccinelli. The last poll I saw had McAuliffe up by about 5 or 6 points, and I think that's probably accurate. He has tons of money. He's outraising Cuccinelli by a fortune on television. And I kind of think that if the election were held today, again, both candidates have their faults, but the Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, would win.
All right. Bobby,
and you know, that's also one of the subtexts about Hillary Clinton as well, because Hillary Clinton is a strong Terry McAuliffe supporter. She's hosting a fundraiser for him next month. Not that he needs fundraising, but I mean, it just shows that the Clinton camp is firmly behind McAuliffe. And that's something, you know, if we're going to talk about calculations, mm-hmm. 2016, the Virginia governor, maybe even Anthony Weiner's campaign in New York City may be part of that calculation, too.
The more Democrats she can get elected now.
Yes, yeah, so that's true. But there's also a certain history that McAuliffe has with the Clintons. They've been pals for a long, long time. Some people think that's not good. But right now, Virginia is changing. It used to be a solid Republican state. Mm-hmm. Obama won it two times in a row, and that never happens in the state of Virginia. So maybe that state is changing. And of course, you know, you have to watch what McAuliffe's victory means for Hillary Clinton.
Bobby in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome, Bobby.
Thank you. Good morning, Andy. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
I'd like to have Ken's prediction. If Hillary is the candidate, it would be the first time in history that the American people know that the first spouse would be a former president of the United States and would be getting like 2-for-1 and the impact that might have on her candidacy.
Well, that's what a lot of the Hillary Clinton supporters in 2008 said, you get two Clintons for the price of one. I just looked it up. If she was elected, though, she would be the oldest woman elected president in history. And so I think people should be aware of that. Of course, she'd be the youngest woman as well. But anyway, so, I mean, look, you know, you either love Bill Clinton or you don't like him. And the New York Times, it seems lately, has been on this kick lately of talking about all the shady financial deals that either Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton or the Clinton Foundation is involved in. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Right now, her ratings are really high. She comes off a very seemingly successful tenure as Secretary of State, although there were questions about Benghazi and things like that. But, I mean, her numbers are very, very good. But, you know, numbers are always very, very good when you're not an actual candidate. Once she gets in the race, once she becomes a declared candidate, you know the Republicans are going to go after her tooth and nail. The problem for the Republicans is that they don't have any uniting figure on their side at all. Everybody seems to be sniping at each other. Mm-hmm. It's not that the Republicans and the Republican conservatives are taking on the Democrats. They're taking on each other, the establishment Republican versus the Tea Party Republican. So for all the fears that Republicans have about Hillary Clinton, they may be too busy knocking each other off and beating each other up to pay attention. And they could wake up one morning and find Hillary Clinton in the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Okay. Bobby, thank you for your call. Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, how much does it – we've been talking a lot about Hillary in terms of Democrats, but how do you see, you know, the worm turning if on the Republican side if Hillary is the candidate, is the nominee?
You mean, do I think that
who can run against her from on the Republican side? Who do you think could?
Well, this is the problem for Republicans. You always hear people like, you know, Jeb Bush or Chris Christie would be much stronger general election candidates in November. But to get to the general election, you have to win the primaries and the caucuses and things like that. And it just seems like the electorate and the rhetoric going on the Republican side is more conservative each cycle. So, I mean, Mitt Romney ostensibly once upon a time was supposed to be the strongest Republican because he would use his business acumen going after President Obama on the state of the economy, things like that. But when you have, you know, you have a right-wing the conversation in the primaries and in debates about deporting immigrants and things like that, it's very hard to turn to this back to the center in November and be convincing about it. So you can talk about Chris Christie, and you know he's the kind of guy. Look, he's winning. He's going to win overwhelming re-election in November in a very blue state. He's the kind of guy the Republicans want, but that doesn't mean Republican voters will want him in the debates when you have Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and folks like that who are very, very conservative and who may be, you know, exactly what these conservative primary voters want.
What about
remember Chris Christie had the temerity of hugging Barack Obama
when
the president came in the state during the Hurricane Sandy tragedy. Well, of course he hugged him. His state was on the ropes, but a lot of Republicans say, you know, you have no business, you know, dealing with the enemy. It's just, there's always an enemy out there, and I think, you know, you risk losing presidential election after presidential election if you have that philosophy.
Well, what do you think about this rebranding of the Republican Party? The folks I've been talking to don't think they achieved really much of anything in that process.
Well, but what rebranding? I mean, every 4 years, the Republicans say, okay, when they lose, especially when I'm talking about when they lose, and they say, well, you know, this time we're going to really pay attention to Latinos. We're going to really pay attention to college students, African Americans. And ultimately, they give good speeches, and ultimately nothing gets done because you still have very conservative members of Congress who are not looking about rebranding. There's many of the House members are saying, look, I was reelected. I was elected and reelected by promising to be very conservative to my conservative voters. Why do I need to move to the middle? Why do I need to change my views on immigration? This is what got me elected to begin with. So, you know, there are some who say that, you know, the Republican Party could be extinct in a couple of years or at least a generation or so because the growing Latino vote. But in the short term, many Republican House members are saying, look, I'm not changing what I want. Look, I promised to vote this way, and I'm not going to change for political expediency.
Thanks to some incredibly successful gerrymandering in the defining of the districts.
Well, there's truth about that. But, you know, a lot of people forget that in the 1980s, when there was growing Republican strength in California, growing Republican strength in Texas, the Democratic legislatures drew the districts to the Democratic side. So both sides play that game if they have the power.
Absolutely.
You talk about Ohio, which is very strong Republican redistricting. Look next door to Illinois, which had very strong Democratic redistricting. Both sides play it, and it just depends who's in power.
But no matter what, I mean, the fact is they don't have to represent the middle or the center of anything whether you come from regardless anymore. I mean, you're in a safe district usually, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
That's exactly right. And that's what the real hidden story about redistricting is. This, you know, once upon a time, if you had a 55-45 district, you really needed to reach out to everybody in the district because that's how you build coalitions to make government work and to get reelected. Now, the name of the game is just getting reelected. Mm-hmm. And if you have a solidly Republican district, why talk to a Democrat? And vice versa, why should a Democrat talk to a Republican if he or she has nothing to fear in the general election by the other side?
And we're talking about talk to someone from the other side of the aisle in a Congress that needs people talking to each other on the other side of the aisle.
It gets worse and worse every cycle. And this is not... I'm not just criticizing Republicans.
No, and it's the same thing in the Ohio General Assembly, too. It's at a state level.
It's just awful. Nothing gets done. And I mean, you know, I love the history of Congress. I love the people, the men and women who have gone there. But why aspire to join a body that just nothing gets done and they just fight? Mm-hmm. And to spend upend your entire life, your financial security to run for Congress to accomplish what? It's just very disheartening.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for him, guess what? Get on the line, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll check it out right away. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. What's the deal with Ted Cruz? So can he or can he not be elected president if he has dual citizenship?
Well, the thing I love so much about the Ted Cruz story is that once upon a time, the whole question was about whether Barack Obama was qualified to become president because of the birth certificate issue. Now, the birth certificate says that Barack Obama was born in Hawaii, which, as far as I know, is one of the top 50 states in the country. But Ted Cruz was born in Canada. Now, of course, he was born to a Cuban father who moved to Canada and an American mother. So the fact that he had an American mother means he has American citizenship and presumably the right to run for president, just as John McCain had the right to run for president, even though he's born in the Panama Canal Zone, but he had two American parents. But it's just so funny that all the birthers who brought up the Obama thing suddenly are saying, wait a second, we could have the same issue with Ted Cruz. Look, the fact that Ted Cruz just released his birth certificate to show that he was born to an American mother in Canada shows that he's thinking about 2016, and there's no question about that. But he had to renounce, I think he renounced his Canadian citizenship, which is sounds a little harsh too. But I guess if you want to be president of the United States, you can't have dual citizenship.
Let's see, Mike in Delaware, you're on the air. Wait, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to live in Delaware, which is one of those districts within Ohio that's been. I'm a Democrat, but I feel like one of the few. So it is difficult to call.
You are one of the few.
Yeah, to call into my congressman. T-Berry, because I'm not picking on him, but this district is what it is, and it's going to go that way. But on a national level, it is very interesting to me what you guys were talking about earlier. I don't think anything Obama could possibly do right now that the Republicans would go along with. And I get what you're saying, but doesn't this, in a strange way, as a Democrat, I almost like this, but it's getting us nowhere over these 8 years. They are driving a bigger and bigger wedge constantly by doing this. What is the interplay between the people at the high end, was my question, versus Congress? So you have Congress fighting. They want to keep their seat, and they want to make sure that somebody right of them doesn't come along. You know, the newest Tea Party member doesn't push them out. But what about the Romneys and who's ever going to run next time? There's got to be something going on there from that I don't want to say level. That's a weird way of putting it. But the people who have aspirations to be presidents or even senators to an extent where your whole state gets to vote – versus Congress. What goes on behind closed doors there? Those people have to be at odds, correct?
Well, they are, but that's exactly the debate that's going on right now in the Republican Party. It's whether not so much to just have to agree or at least agree to negotiate, but there are some people who just say that negotiation is a sign of weakness, and that's true about foreign policy and immigration policy and tax policy and Obamacare, health policy, and all that stuff. But so you do have some Republicans like Jeb Bush, like Chris Christie, who said, look, the name of the game is not taking absolute positions and just sticking to it. It's compromising and talking. I think one of the reasons Jeb Bush's star has fallen is because he's talked so much about compromise. And compromise is the kind of dirty word that doesn't do well in the kind of Republican debates and conversations that are going on now. So it's a very frustrating thing. I mean, once upon a time, there was a Rockefeller versus Goldwater wing of the Republican Party where you had a moderate and a conservative. There really isn't the moderates anymore. It's really the establishment conservatives versus the Tea Party conservatives. And until they get their act together, you know, you could say that, well, you know, they'll hold on to the House, certainly until 2020. They could very well possibly win the Senate in 2014. They need six, but there are about six or seven states that are perhaps ripe for the picking. But at the same time, their chances of winning the presidency, I mean, look, if they're going to win, it's because maybe the voters will be tired or disappointed with Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or whoever the Democrats are, but not because of the excitement over the Republican candidate. And they seem to be more interested in running a no campaign rather than a yes campaign. And that works maybe for Congress, but not for president.
Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Let's see, Ronald
Mike didn't sound happy at the end of
that. Mike didn't sound like anything at all. Maybe he'd already hung up. Ronald in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome, Ronald.
Welcome. I just wanted to say earlier he talked about people uprooting their lives and giving up their financial security. I think that misses the point. I think a lot of people in Congress are actually making a lot more money in the time they're in Congress to the time they leave than they did before they even came in. And they're making a lot more contacts. And a lot of the problems that we have are because of the money in politics. We need these elections funded by the government, and the amount of money needs to be lowered, and the people would have more of a say in what's going on. And I think that's why, you got these guys, like you take Ohio. I would not be surprised if Ohio has more Democrats than Republicans, and yet Republicans totally dominate the assembly. Now, yeah, they did a lot of gerrymandering to get there, but it's also because of the amount of money that's in politics.
Well, yeah, if there wasn't money in politics, maybe Jesse Jackson Jr. wouldn't be going to prison right now.
That's true.
Yeah. Ken Rudin?
Well, I think Ronald makes a good point, but at the same time, it's not just people in Congress who are making money. Look at Bill Clinton. He's worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And remember, when he was president, perhaps part of the because of the investigations and the legal stuff that's going on. But I mean, he didn't have a lot of money at all, and now he's a multi millionaire. So both sides, everybody seems to make. I don't think Clinton went into politics to make the money, but he certainly is. He and Hillary. I think she's getting $200,000 per speech.
They have a foundation now.
Well, then there's a foundation and whatever's going on with that. But the point is, look, the Supreme Court has ruled on that. And, this goes back to the earlier conversation about the importance of the Supreme Court, that the famous Citizens United decision that says basically that, there's no limit on money for a political cause. Well, again, a split Supreme Court decided that. And again, if President Obama or the next Democrat has opportunities to change the court, if there are retirements on the conservative side, that could change. But other than that, incumbents don't want to have public financing of elections because as an incumbent, you want to have the advantage. So both sides, I think, like the system the way it is, even though there's a lot of complaints about the money in it. Look, Bill Clinton just gave $100,000 to Terry McAuliffe to run for governor of Virginia. That's a lot of money. So the fact is money does rule, and I don't know what changes are like. What will change with that unless there's a change of the Supreme Court?
Thanks a lot, Ronald, for that call. Jackie in Columbus, you're a Republican. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so mad at the Republican. I've been a voting Republican. I've been a Republican all my life because my dad was, and that's when I registered to vote. He'd have been really upset if I hadn't have registered as a Republican. And I have voted Republican generally, but I'm sick of Republicans right now. I'm sick of what's been going on in Congress. I'm sick of the Tea Party. I'm sick of some of the Christians acting like Muslim radicals with no abortion and all this stuff. And I have stayed Republican recently so that I could look for a moderate to vote for in the primaries. But I've been voting Democrat, and I'm going to not only vote for Democrats, but I'm going to start working for Democrats. I'm so mad at the Republicans, and that's the way I feel.
Jackie sounds bitter, Ken.
She's smiling, but I think it's smiling through clenched teeth. Look, there are Republicans who say if it weren't for the Tea Party, if it weren't for the activists and the conservative activists, we wouldn't have John Boehner as Speaker of the House. It's the Tea Party that really got the Republicans to their status as majority in the House. But having said that, I hear that all the time, and they always say that you know, Nixon or Reagan or any of those, but they would never recognize the Republican Party in 2013, 2014, let alone get elected or nominated in this kind of party. But this is what's happened to the party. Once upon a time, Mitt Romney voted for same-sex, he was pro-choice on abortion. He voted for, you know, the kind of stuff that many moderate Republicans supported. But once he ran for president, he looked at the terrain and he said, look, I can be, you know, I could, you know, keep to my past positions, but I'll never get anywhere. And so it's just so amazing to see what happens. It would be fascinating to see if Jeb Bush does decide to run. He's not gotten great reviews in his last couple of speeches, but he has said over and over again that the Republicans are committing political suicide with its views on abortion and immigration and things like that, and they're ignoring the changing demographics of this country. If you had a Bush or Christie, you know, who was a nominee who would talk about that, that would be very interesting. But look, a nominee for president, the purpose of his or her role is not to attack his own party. He has to go after the other party. And so it would be so nice to see, it would be refreshing to see a Republican to say that, you know, our party is committing suicide. But that kind of Republican could never win a nomination because that's not where the voters are right now.
Are Republicans like Jackie just not showing up at the polls?
They're showing up. But as Jackie said, she's now voting for Democrats. But you know something? All those Republicans who got sick of the Republicans in 2006 and a lot of them stayed home or voted for Democrats, and that's how Nancy Pelosi mm-hmm. became Speaker. But by the same token, a lot of these Republicans came back in 2010 when they got tired or didn't like what they saw with Obama. A lot of Democrats didn't like what they saw with Obama, and a lot of Democrats stayed home in 2010, and that's how the Republicans did so well in the midterm elections. It seems like who could least alienate the bread and butter of the party, the soul of the party? If it just seems like it's now no longer are people voting for something. It's just holding their nose and deciding to vote against somebody.
All right, Jackie, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to try to squeeze in one more. Norman and Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome, Norman.
Yes, you know, I think the whole problem boils down to we got to get a multi-member district.
What does that mean?
That means that, in other words, you would break up your districts. You would have make them large enough so that you would have a choice of two or three people to vote for within a district. And so, generally, what happens if you favor one party, that's your choice, and then you have two other candidates you could vote for. And generally, what happens is people are going to vote for their strongest thing, whether it's gender or whether it's party or whether it's religion. And then after they get their one person in there, then they'll consider some other people. And I've been in places where they had multi-member districts, and it's terrific.
Ken Rudin?
Well, Norman, explain to me what you mean. I mean, never in Congress they've had that. You're talking about other countries,
like,
right?
That's where it all starts at. Not in countries. I'm just talking about in states. Hawaii used to be a multi-member district, and you had it in certain other states. I think New Mexico and a few other. And so it's all legal and it's all constitutional. And that way you would have in your district you would have a choice of two to three candidates.
Like maybe like a runoff? Is that what he's, you know, we're running out of time. That's why
California in California now all the candidates, regardless of party, are on the same ballot. And so in other words, and you need 50% to advance to the general election. So in many congressional districts, the choice in November were two Democrats or two Republicans. Are you talking about something like that?
Yeah, I guess it sounds like what he's talking about, but we're running out of time now.
Well,
so
they do have that in some states, and that may be the way of the future.
All right, Ken, in 15 seconds, can you tell people where you're going? Because we have callers who want to know who might not have heard what you said earlier, and we only have 15 seconds.
I'm doing more and more conversations like this with member stations around the country. Next month, a new political junkie program will be formed with perhaps a 14, 15-minute segment each week that other stations can pick up.
Okay.
And then there will be Return of the Political Junkie column and the Scuttlebutt and Puzzle. And,
Yay!
and I'll be selling pictures of myself online.
Ken, it was great talking to you today. Thank you so much.
And a lot of fun. Thank you.
Take care. Ken Rudin. For now, NPR's Political Junkie. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.